Yes, welcome to the proposition that big changes are afoot in the way the world lives and works. I'm Peter Day, and I'm looking at the BRICS, the assertion that Brazil, Russia, India, and China will be global economic powerhouses by the year 2050. This week I'm examining what's already happening to make those changes very likely indeed. Certainly there's a new spirit of optimism, a new assertiveness even, among some of the people in the BRICS. I'm watching a troupe of dancers rehearsing in a studio in Sao Paulo. My host is the musician Guga Stota, who says Brazilians no longer have to dance to the West's tune.
With some recent recuperation of Brazilian economy, the Brazilian young people are feeling maybe angry about the American influence.
Time for America to move over. Time for Brazil to take its place on the world stage properly. It's going to be a confusing future, isn't it?
What I feel is that the leadership of many places are really stupid. What Blair does with Bush is ridiculous. What Bush does is ridiculous. And Berlusconi is ridiculous. So I don't feel so much inferior like I used to feel.
Brazilian musician Guga Stota. Some of the brightest minds in the normally dismal science of economics agree that great big upheaval is on the way.
We're already seeing the dispersal of economic power and influence, I think, in the world in the early stages.
Michael Spence is the Nobel Prize-winning economist from Stanford University in California.
Let's take the status quo. We have 2.5 large economies that also happen to be advanced. The 2.5 are the United States, Europe, and then you have Japan. So that's part of the current landscape. And then you have China growing like a weed, but still at a tenth the size of the United States economy. In India, at half that size again, with a similar population. But what you're seeing because of the growth of those economies, you can see them acting in the WTO and in other places in a way that's much more influential than they used to be, say, 25 or 30 years ago.
The American economist Michael Spence. And some of that dispersal, that redistribution of economic power that Michael Spence talks about, is quite literally in the air.
We are looking in Europe to fly over Milan or Rome, Zurich. We are looking at Amsterdam. We are looking at
Naresh Munich. Goyal is the founder of one of India's new private airlines, Jet Airways, and one of India's richest men, an up-to-date example of how the business world is changing shape as developing countries flex their muscles, even though so many of their citizens are still very poor. He's building his new business around the rise of Brazil, Russia, India, and China.
We're in Russia, we're looking at different places. We are having plans to fly to India, China. We're looking at flying from India, China, beyond China with our new bilateral to the US and other places.
Let's look at BRICS, this theory of that the world will have a completely different sort of economic and industrial landscape to it by the year 2050. The Goldman Sachs thesis. What does the airline map, if we spread it out in front of us, the airline map in 2050 will show completely different sort of lines on it from the one we see today, won't it?
You're absolutely right. I'll tell you, I see that India, China are going to be the biggest economies in the world. As far as India is concerned, the traffic will grow. 50 years, I can't really predict. I don't know what's going to happen in 50 years. I can tell you in the next year, 10 years, the traffic will grow at the rate of about 15%, if not more domestic.
And it's growing at 3% or something worldwide all the time. So this is far outstripping the global increase, which is itself year on year pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And the international will grow at the rate of 7 to 8 or 10%.
Look, as I take off, though, from Mumbai or Delhi in a jet on one of your flights, as soon as I'm up in the air, I fly over and look down at the cooking pot fires down below me in the shanty towns. Terrible poverty just down there. Unless that changes, India will not get more prosperous or much more prosperous than it is now. Prosperity must extend to the poor in India as well, mustn't it?
I must tell you, with the new government we have in place, they came out with a minimum common program. You know, before the reforms did not take into consideration that the reforms must reach a poor person in a village who doesn't have food, who doesn't have shelter, who doesn't have drinking water. That's a part of the minimum common program. I think everybody's realizing that. And as the economy grows, the GDP grows, I think the people's, the standard of living will improve.
Yes, here where I am now, there's a stinging poignancy about all this talk of India's economic ascendancy. I'm visiting the makeshift camps along the main road leading to the airport in Mumbai, India's business and mass media capital. These are the people whose cooking pot fires you see from Mr. Goyal's jetliners. Up there, the privilege of India and the world cross the skies. Down here, people such as 18-year-old Rameeb are working for 60 rupees a day, $1.5, making roads for India's new cars. But she's happy, she says, she'll be able to take the money back to her husband's family farm, 2 days' travel from here, and plant better crops. In India, the town and the countryside are worlds and centuries apart. Here we are in the farming village of Tilpat, less than 20 kilometres from the government offices and cyber cafes of the capital, Delhi. Badlay Ram takes deep draws on his hookah pipe in the village meeting place. As this careworn 70-year-old voices his doubts about the Goldman Sachs vision of India's future, the villagers around him nod in agreement. People say that India is going to get very, very rich in the next 50 years. Do you think it will do?
It can happen, I suppose. But the road you travel on to get here is very bad. It's in very bad shape, and the government's doing nothing about it. Electricity, if it comes on for a very short time.
Or will be great, one day, perhaps.
Yes,
India can become great. We have hope that things will improve. But when we look at the present situation, we have doubts. We have a very sacred temple in this village. Many important people, even members of parliament, come to it using this same bad road. They come and they go, but the condition of the road remains the same.
Ready?
Silence!
Hundreds of miles away in a disco in Mumbai, they're toiling away at that great barometer of a changing society, a television commercial. Writhing bodies, an atmospheric fog machine, a sultry temptress in a red dress sidles up to the commercial's hero. Cut!
Check the premix. We're starting with
the ads producer is well aware of the two worlds he's embracing.
I'm Prahlad Kakkar from India. I shoot commercials. We're shooting a commercial for a product from a brand called Parachute, which is a styling cream.
For the men?
It's for men. And the brand ambassador for this particular brand is a man called Yuvraj Singh. And he's a very popular young cricketer, other than being a good-looking hunk.
And he gets the girl.
The girl gets him. I think we're turning that whole thing around.
We're looking at this thesis that the Goldman Sachs thesis of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, rising right up the economic powerhouse list in the next 20, 30, 40 years. Now, what you're doing is part of that process, actually, isn't it?
Well, we are part of a process which is converting a relatively agrarian society into a consumer society. The numbers in India are massive. So everybody is just waiting for some degree of the wealth to be distributed equally among a lot of the poorer sections of society so that their buying power increases. This is a very Western concept of capitalism. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
And there's still that sort of tug of war in the Indian mind, is there?
Well, there's a tug of war because the fallout of a westernized driven economy, which is a capitalist society, is so obvious.
Prahlad Kakkar. No such qualms detectable in Parachute's brand manager, Samir Satpati.
If you don't move forward, you die. That's the basic rule of capitalism. If you don't plan for tomorrow's consumer, you're not going to survive. People are saying that we're taking away jobs. It's because we are more efficient. Today, what you're seeing is the tip of the iceberg. It's just the beginning. We are hungrier, better trained, and we are ready to take on the world.
This commercial is for a new product, quite a big launch.
Yeah, it's a big launch. Indians are getting younger and richer, which is suddenly creating a market which was not there a few years back. So we need to bring in grooming products, which are a little upper end, which would have existed only in salons in India for the top end. Now that would become the middle class, and it's happening right before our eyes.
And you've got places to sell these in, have you? Shops with a suitable sort of ambience, because that was lacking in India until recently.
Yeah, retail is opening up, but we expect these products to start moving not only in malls, but also in what we call as Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 towns. Because today with television and the net, it's one country. It's about an urban mindset. It's not about urban India.
Ah, that's so interesting, because there has been this split between the cities and the countryside. But you see this stuff because you see television, you see your advertising, and yet can you afford it? Can you aspire to it? Isn't it creating enormous tensions in a developing country?
Yes, there is a consuming class, and there's a percentage of people under the poverty line. But we are in the mass business. The brands, the products which we launch have to appeal to the masses.
You have to rethink your operation along the price level that Indians and maybe poor Indians can afford.
Absolutely. It's about value delivery.
Here's a company and a brand embracing the new consumer society wherever it emerges, in village or metropolis or slum.
Coca-Cola, Sirigis Musicae.
In fact, with developing countries such as Brazil, Russia, India and China on the rise, a whole new market of trainee consumers is being born. Billions of new consumers, and the overwhelming majority of them drawn from the ranks of people many Western marketing executives habitually dismiss as the poor. And thanks to falling trade barriers and opening economies, they're all finally able to buy into at least part of that dream of abundance the advertisements dangle before them. It is the companies which can tap that market which will survive and thrive in this future world. As the poor have a little more to spend, this is where fortunes are going to be made.
Silence!
Sound!
But back at the ad shoot in Mumbai, I wonder, can India build a consumer society and still hold on to its Gandhi-inspired soul? I put this to the thoughtful producer of commercials, Prahlad Kakkar.
See, the most interesting thing about India is that 60%, almost 70% of the population of this country is below 40 years old or 35 years old. And it's going to remain young for a very long time. And we are probably evolving as one of the youngest, most dynamic, changing societies in Southeast Asia or Asia as such, and therefore in the world.
And certainly more than China is.
Definitely more than China is. Also, the language that we conduct our business in is English, has always been. The language that you dream in is the vernacular. But today, more often than not, the young people dream in two languages. They dream in English, and they dream in the vernacular. So they actually straddle two worlds. So when we're talking about the future of this country, it's going to be very, very interesting, because it's going to evolve into something that we've never seen before. Because we are going to evolve as a nation of two language dreamers. And that, believe me, is the most significant difference between India and any other country in the world.
Changing dreams, changing markets, and rapidly shifting societies. You're listening to BRICS, the changing face of world power, here on the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Day. I've just been looking at the signs that the BRICS predictions may be starting to come true, that Brazil, Russia, India, and China are indeed on the road to undreamt of wealth and power. Now I want to examine whether present-day obstacles will stop one or all of these countries from actually reaching that promised destination. This is Chinese Rhapsody by the young Chinese composer Gay Gan Ru, performed in the West by the Scottish National Orchestra. The collision of cultures can create new and hybrid music such as this. But Western investors have tended to be less than rhapsodic about their encounters with Chinese business culture.
I asked the courageous Chinese journalist Hu Shuli, the founder editor of the financial newspaper Kai Jing, to assess the business climate in China today.
I think doing business in China, like 2 years ago, will be different from now. It's closer to international model.
What about corruption? I know people who tried to do business in China and had a terrible time. Phantom companies being set up that siphoned off their investments and that kind of thing. I mean, it was really very difficult for Western investors, even with joint ventures. You thought you were going in legitimately, and in fact, you got very cheated indeed. This is fairly recent. You say it's changed.
But I have to say, if foreign companies compromise with such kind of corruption, they will be part of the corruption. China hates corruption as well. The government and also the people have worked very hard to do something against it.
But of course, the government in China, as in many places, is part of the corruption cycle, isn't it?
Yes or no? I think subjectively, the government doesn't want to be part of the corruption. But actually or objectively, because government has controlled too much economic resources, it helps to be part of the corruption. So we have to have reform.
So transparency is part of the change from total state ownership to private ownership. It comes as one of those things.
Yes, I think transparency is important, and so journalists are important.
That's where you come in.
Yeah, that's why, yeah. Independent-minded journalists are very, very necessary in China.
Are you a brave woman? Do you feel ever under threat? This is a wild world you're getting involved in. This is a new sort of business for China.
I think China is quite a secure country. I feel very safe.
Hu Shuli, editor and founder of the financial weekly Kai Jing. And what of doing business in Russia? Listen to the entrepreneur Sergei Vykotsev.
Today I had my fourth child born, so I really think that's the future we've got for them is better than what we've experienced. And I really believe in our economical growth and huge potential of this country.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. More than some question.
Now to the founder of what's perhaps India's most notorious investigative website, now a newspaper, Tehelka. Tarun Tejpal is famous for exposing bribery.
It's very difficult. I mean, we struggle every day to keep the paper going.
You, of course, cover corruption, a lot of corruption in Tehelka. That's one of the jobs this newspaper does. And that's one of the problems, maybe, to the onwards and upwards evolution of India, politics and economics.
See, corruption is a problem, but I don't think it's such an insurmountable problem. I think, for one, you have corruption at the high echelons everywhere in the world. I think as societies refine themselves, the corruption levels decline. If you look back at Europe in the early 20th century, I think that was no different from India. You know, municipal disasters, sanitation disasters, transportation disasters, you know, governance disasters. I mean,
and great critical revelations too from newspaper people like yourself.
Exactly.
With the future of India, the people on Wall Street, people in the City of London say it's going to happen over the next 20, 30, 40 years, that India is going to take its rightful economic and maybe geopolitical place in the world. Does that look likely from where you are?
I think it's absolutely inevitable. I'm in fact among those who believes that if I had to put money between India and China, I would put all my money on India. And I say that because I think no one's taking enough account of the torque that will come when China begins to taste liberty.
You're an optimist, aren't you?
I wouldn't be here if I weren't. The only reason I survived is I'm an optimist by choice.
here you are putting sensations and corruption and scandals on your front pages. But you're an optimist about the way things will go.
I think actually India's in a great shape. I mean, my job, I'm a journalist. I'm a professional dissenter. I need to blow the whistle. I do my job.
If you're not careful, though, it'll all go away and you won't have anything to blow the whistle on anymore.
I mean, that would be wonderful. I can retire and write my books then.
Corruption, too, a problem in Brazil, along with that yawning gap between rich and poor found in all four BRICS countries. Here in Sao Paulo, the super-rich commute in helicopters above the slums of the poor. Is that poverty, the squalid, savage poverty of the urban slums, like corruption, also just a passing historical phase, something Brazil and the other BRICS countries might simply outgrow? We've heard from three of the BRICS countries. Our final stop, Brazil, the B in the BRICS.
A lot of these projections are just extrapolations. They're fantasy. What we live is reality. And I think reality is improving in this country.
Norman Gall is a much-traveled American who founded the Fernand Braudel Institute of World Economics in Sao Paulo to do hands-on research into the huge urban problems of the favelas, the slums of the developing world. What does this gnarled expat make of the BRICS predictions? After 100 years of failing to live up to its promise, is Brazil finally turning round?
Life in the favelas where we work have been improving. There's been more infrastructure, there are more schools, people are living better, there are more businesses. Streets have been paved, streets now are lighted. All of these things work together to make these more civilized societies.
It's something like the decline of the London slums in the 19th century then? They were terrible, the slums in the middle, the 1850s?
Oh yes, it's like also Berlin in the 19th century, though it was surrounded by squatter settlements. This is a process that has recurred throughout history.
What about the existing nations seated at the top table of the world? They're going to have to move over if India, China, Brazil and Russia get to the eminence that some people think they're going to get to. Is that going to be an uncomfortable process?
Not necessarily. So I think that the people at the top of the table, mainly the Europeans and the Japanese, are rapidly aging societies. They have social systems which cannot be sustained. They don't have the manpower to conduct military enterprises. So these are fading powers. And I really don't see how they can really obstruct a vigorous new powers that are arising. I don't think that this is a problem. The United States, these problems are less because of immigration and because the United States is basically still a much more dynamic society than either the European countries or Japan.
And it won't, its industries won't feel bruised by the inexorable rise into services, into software, into innovation, into inventing things?
This has always happened in the history of the world. And people adapt.
Readily, psychologically, they adapt. I suppose the British Empire got used to fading.
Well, they did, didn't they?
Norman Gall. In an increasingly globalizing world, rich and poor are living ever closer together as television and the internet bring down the barriers of time and space. Economists insist that the poor will not stay poor, that these BRICS countries will rise to the top. To the destitute in the slums and the farmers in the countryside, it all seems rather unlikely, as we've heard. But if it actually happens, what will these changes mean for the rest of us? A question for my report next week from the BRICS Nations on the Rise.